Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Historian Beverly Gage spent 2 years traveling across the U.S., observing and learning how Americans tell their national story. Her 13 extended trips, 13 colonies, remember, took her to 300 historical sites. They included battlefields, presidential libraries, factories, civil rights landmarks, and yes, Disneyland. The resulting book, This Land Is Your Land, takes its title from Woody Guthrie's timeless folk song. His lyrics include this apt summary of Beverly Gage's adventures. I've roamed and rambled and I followed my footsteps. She did that and then some. Along the way, she took a long look at this part of America too, from the State House in Columbia, South Carolina to Fort Sumter and over to the Atlanta of MLK and Coca-Cola. She's here today to share her perspective on the tortured, heroic, and sometimes bizarre, looking at Phil Collins in the Alamo, history of our nation. Beverly Gage, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thanks, Eric. It's great to be here.
I should mention that Dr. Beverly Gage is a professor of history at Yale University. This is her third book. So before we get into what you saw, you make the observation that, quote, apparently the nation intends to mark its 250th anniversary by chastising and defunding the very programs and institutions, the National Park Service, the National Archives, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and many others, that make its history accessible, end quote. So what are two or three tangible steps you would like to see Congress and or the next administration take to restore our historical equilibrium?
Well, I obviously should have included National Public Radio in that list, among many others.
Thank you.
Well, you know, what's so striking about this moment in that sense is that if you look at the bicentennial in 1976, the bicentennial occasioned a huge wave of investment in historic sites, in particular, new ways of telling the American story, the inclusion of new groups and new characters in that story. And today we seem to be seeing very much the opposite, which is trying to push some of those histories out, trying to dismantle some of these institutions. In a very basic way, I think it would be much more productive to celebrate the 250th by ensuring federal funding for particularly places like the National Park Service, which does so much work to make American history accessible to Americans, you know, in a very even-handed, very bipartisan, extremely thoughtful and professional way. And so I have thought that what's happening at the National Park Service in particular is a real shame for this moment when so many Americans want to hit the road and want to go out and see their country and learn its history.
I'm glad you mentioned the bicentennial because I was going to take a quick detour here in our interview because you recently appeared on a New Yorker podcast with Jill Lepore, who, like yourself, is a Pulitzer Prize winning historian. And the two of you discussed how Americans felt ambivalent about the 1976 bicentennial, similar to what we've heard this year. And Jill Lepore in that conversation played clips from an obscure man on the street project that she discovered at the National Archives, with one participant telling an interviewer that 1976 was, quote, a bad time to have the bicentennial, end quote. So I'm curious, other than it being a bad time to have a bicentennial or a sesquicentennial, I can never say it, how would you compare 1976 and 2026?
Well, it is a very funny video that Jill came across, in part because it's filled with all of these quintessentially 1970s man on the street characters in, you know, sort of perfect 1970s uniform of varying sorts. But I think it's also instructive because while I was saying, you know, the bicentennial, I think was a moment when this kind of investment in history happened, when a lot of people looked to kind of bringing the country together, thinking about its history, all of these kind of cheery things. 1976 was also a moment when we had just come out of Watergate, just, you know, crashed to the disastrous end of the Vietnam War. It was a period of economic malaise and collapse. It was the middle of a pretty hard-fought presidential election. And so I think that a lot of the people in that video were reflecting their own ambivalence, both about the moment that they were living in and about the broader sweep of American history, which is, of course, a story of highs and lows and amazing things and wild injustices.
Semi-quincentennial. Is that right? Did I get it right?
That's right. You got it.
Very good. All right. So when the national celebrations began a couple of weeks ago for 250, David Smith wrote in The Guardian, quote, "If that's the way America celebrates its birthday, you would not want to be present at its funeral," end quote. What do you make of what we've seen this year?
Well, I think the first thing about the 250th is how relatively muted the run-up to the 250th has been. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book that I wrote starting in 2023 and 24, was to, you know, have some way to relate to this moment at a moment when it seems like a lot of people actually want to turn away from these big questions and marking an occasion like the 250th. So I was in D.C. a few weeks ago as the, quote, Great American State Fair was going up on the Mall. And I was really struck by, first of all, that they were still building everything. This was, you know, pretty late in the game. But also how much more modest the ambitions are than if you look back to 1926 or 1876, right? In 1876, Philadelphia for the centennial had this massive blowout, basically a world's fair with all sorts of new buildings constructed and entire neighborhoods rebuilt. And something like 20% of the American population descended on Philadelphia to see this and participate in this. And these kind of little weird plywood things that are going up on the Mall seem pretty second best. And it did, it was a moment when I thought, huh, I'm not much of a declinist, but I thought, huh, maybe we really are a country in decline here. Had a similar feeling about the UFC fight. But I will say, you know, at least something is happening. And Donald Trump has been one of the people who, since the moment he came on the political scene in 2015 and 16, started talking about the 250th at a moment when other people weren't thinking about it at all. So at least there's something going on.
That's the voice of Beverly Gage. She is a professor of history at Yale University. She is also the author of This Land Is Your Land, A Road Trip Through U.S. History. Okay, let's talk about what you saw, what you did. So there are so many things I love about this book, and one of them is the way you connect narrative threads among chapters. You'll call back, for example, Rosa Parks' bus boycott in 1955 from your Deep South section when you reach California and mention that Disneyland opened the same year. That said, I'm wondering, how did 2 years of travel change the way that you view America?
I did most of the travel for this book in 2023 and 2024, looking ahead to this moment in 2026. And I think the main thing that stood out to me that I hadn't quite expected was that I saw so many connections between the different places that I was going. The book is set up in 13 chapters, and each chapter is both a place and a moment in time. So it starts in Philadelphia with the American Revolution. That also happens to be my hometown. And it ends, as all good road trips must, on the other side of the country in California, in this case, in Southern California in the late 20th century. But it moves all around in between. And I kept seeing these themes, these images, these particular people and characters who I would see in one place and then run into again in another one. You know, Rosa Parks is a good example. There's the The fact that Disneyland is opening at the same time that Rosa Parks is making her protest. It's also true that the bus where Rosa Parks registered that protest is now sitting in a museum in Dearborn, Michigan, that I also went to, that Henry Ford had established earlier on because he was very interested in American history and wanted to put his own stamp on it. And so there's all of this swirl and all of these connections that I just hadn't anticipated.
Yeah, on that on the bus piece, it was interesting. I believe you wrote that it was languishing somewhere in a field or something in Alabama, and then Henry Ford snapped it up.
That's right. The Henry Ford Museum.
Henry Ford Museum. He was, yeah.
Yeah, Henry Ford was himself long gone.
He was not eternal. I apologize.
Exactly. As much as he might have wanted to be and thought that he deserved to be, he was not eternal.
I mentioned your travels to the South. The closest you came to North Carolina was South Carolina and Virginia. I guess we could throw Tennessee in there as well. You may have heard the saying that North Carolina is a veil of humility between two mountains of conceit. You probably lived that. So if you had considered North Carolina, where might you have gone?
I might have included it in the civil rights chapter. Mm-hmm. Might have gone to Greensboro and thought about that moment. I guess that's the first place that comes to mind. It is true that I kind of circled around North Carolina. There's South Carolina. There's Georgia. There is Virginia, as you say. There's some Tennessee. But for the record, there is also nothing about New England in this book, which is where I actually live. And in part, there are many places that are missing just for practical reasons, but some of them are really obvious historic places like Boston or New York or Washington, D.C. Those are not in the book either. And so that's just for the record.
We're not taking it personally. We're not taking it personally.
Okay, thank you.
In South Carolina, you went to one of the places you went was Beaufort, which is part of a coastal area that went from secession hotbed to a model of the potential of Reconstruction. How did that evolution occur and how did it unravel?
Well, thinking about how I was going to handle the Civil War was one of the great challenges of this book, because I was not going to go to every Civil War battlefield. And I still think of everything that Americans engage in our history, the Civil War really is the first place that people, that you're going to hit the road, you're going to the Civil War sites, right? Mm. That's probably what you're going to run into. So I chose South Carolina because it seemed to have sort of interesting juxtaposition. On the one hand, as everyone knows, the first state of secession, Fort Sumter, is still there. You can go and visit. And Charleston in particular is really saturated with that kind of Civil War history. But there are also these really interesting new experiments going on in historic sites, both in Charleston and then, as you said, down in Beaufort. Which was the site of this incredible experiment, what one historian called the rehearsal for Reconstruction, because the Sea Islands were taken over very, very early in the war by the Union Army. Most of the white people living in that region really just fled ahead of the advancing Union military, but the enslaved people mostly stayed. And so as early as 1862, 63, 64, you're beginning to see these experiments there in Black education, land ownership, political participation. And so now there are these sites devoted to those experiments, and you can go to Beaufort, to several different sites, and find out a little bit more about that piece of the story.
And we're going to find out a little bit more, a little cliffhanger there, about Beaufort and South Carolina and some of the places and people that Beverly Gage saw on her long, long road trip through historic America. The name of the book is This Land Is Your Land. We'll have more with historian Beverly Gage. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte, celebrating 95 years of impact in the Carolinas, strengthening nonprofits, neighborhoods, and people through the support of charitable contributions. More at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is Beverly Gage. She is a history professor at Yale, and she is also a best-selling author. Her biography of J. Edgar Hoover won the Pulitzer and just about every other prize. Her new book is This Land Is Your Land. Beverly, we were talking about Beaufort and the Reconstruction experiment that was going on there. Anyone who's been to Beaufort, as you have, has probably driven on Robert Small's Parkway. It's one of the main roads there. Robert Small's life is nothing short of incredible, as you write about in the book. What are a few things that stand out to you about Robert Small's?
Well, he was born into slavery in Beaufort and became sort of a skilled tradesman of varying sorts, and was someone who ended up being rented out for his services, the money, of course, going back to the family that owned him. When the war came along, he was pressed into service for the Confederacy as a boat pilot, and he had his eye on other things, and so he seized the moment one evening when a lot of the ship's white crew headed off to shore and took his ship and piloted it over to the Union lines and became a Union hero. He ended up staying in that role on the Union side and in various other roles, but then he ultimately returned to Beaufort with some of the reward money as a very well-established figure. He bought some of the land on the plantation where he had once been enslaved, and then built this extraordinary political career. He entered Congress and stayed there for about 30 years, and he was one of the last kind of Black politicians to come out of the Reconstruction era. He stayed in Congress actually until the 1890s, which was a very long time and very unusual. He helped write the South Carolina Reconstruction Constitution, which was very progressive, particularly around questions of race and property ownership. And then, of course, when a new South Carolina Constitution came in the 1890s, you know, he, like many other Black politicians, was ultimately forced out of office.
And I believe you wrote, this is something I did not know, that a statue of Robert Smalls is planned or maybe already installed in the State House in South Carolina?
So that was, that was underway when I was writing the book. I'm actually not sure if it's there now or not.
I'll go check. and you mentioned Charleston earlier. You spent a good amount of time in Charleston. You encounter the racist pro-slavery politician John C. Calhoun on your travels, or rather the image of John C. Calhoun. You describe his legacy in his home state as being contradictory. How so?
Well, I think Calhoun, for the two centuries really since his political career, has been revered in certain circles as a statesman, as a person of great political sophistication and intelligence, as a real force in the Senate and as vice president, having played all of these different roles in American political life. And then, of course, as the single most vociferous defender of slavery as not just a necessary evil, which is what a lot of the founders thought, but by the 1820s, 1830s, Calhoun's beginning to defend it as a positive good. And so Calhoun has just been such a central figure in South Carolina broadly, but in Charleston in particular. And that was literally true until about a decade ago, that gigantic statue of Calhoun that was standing sort of gazing out over the city after the shootings at the Mother Emanuel Church. That statue was taken down. And I would say, Calhoun's contradictions and problems are really front and center in any engagement with him. Actually, at Yale, I was on a committee about a decade ago because we had a residential college named after Calhoun. It was Calhoun College. There were lots of protests on campus wanting to have that name changed. And our president sort of waffled back and forth about whether to change the name. And so then they finally brought in a team of historians to try to figure out, you know, who John Calhoun really was and whether it was okay to change the name. And it was changed in the end.
And you mentioned, as with so many things, not only in the South, but across our country, we remove a symbol that is offensive or doesn't align with where contemporary values are. And yet, with John C. Calhoun, there is a statue of him sitting right there in the State House that I think you mentioned everybody just kind of walks by and pretends isn't there.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that you see as you travel the country is just the wild variability in how different places, different communities, different people approach these kinds of questions. Some of it has to do with the structure of state or local laws, particularly around Confederate monuments. Others has to do with political power and who has sway. Different communities have different moral relationships to all of these stories. But I don't think in the United States there's been one consistent approach. And of course, now we're in a situation of some madness where things that had been renamed are being unrenamed. And so that's
yes.
just a whole
Fort
new
Liberty,
chapter
Fort
in
Bragg,
the story.
Yes.
Right, exactly.
You mentioned Mother Emanuel and the horrible massacre that took place there in 2015. South Carolina, as you know, finally removed the Confederate flag from the State House grounds after that tragedy. But inside the Capitol, as we were just talking, symbols and statuary of racial oppression and slavery remain prominently displayed. Why, and I know it's been asked forever, but I'm going to ask you, as I'm sure plenty of others have, why is the lost cause so impossibly difficult to shed?
It's a great question, and it is one of the longstanding and most powerful questions, I think, in modern American history. I think in part it's because there are a set of lived experiences and family connections. This is a war that was fought mostly on Southern soil, and so there's a deep sense of local connection to the Lost Cause as well. But of course, as a narrative, the Lost Cause is something that was produced in part in the late 19th century to build up a story about why Jim Crow was necessary, why racial segregation was necessary. And it has often been deployed in moments of racial backlash for that reason as well. A lot of the Confederate memorials that we see around the country didn't get erected suddenly right during or after the Civil War. It was one or two, sometimes even three generations later, in a very different political moment for very different political reasons, that we have all of this Confederate imagery and really the Lost Cause story as a whole.
That is the voice of Beverly Gage. She's a professor of history at Yale University, and her new book is called This Land Is Your Land. One of the best examples, or I don't know if best is the right word, but one of the examples that stands out the most that you point to is a statue of former U.S. Senator Strom Thurmond, who retired at age 100 in 2003. You note that his statue in the Capitol includes a plaque that had to be amended. What was added?
That's right. Strom Thurmond, this very, very long-serving political figure, first as governor and then entering D.C. politics for decade after decade, becoming one of these Southern politicians who just has seniority like you couldn't even imagine seniority, right? into his 90s, and as you said, dying at 101. That statue originally had the names of his children, his publicly acknowledged children from his officially recognized family. After his death, it was revealed, something that many people said had been an open secret in many circles for quite a long time, that he was also the father of a Black woman and had some form of sexual relationship with a woman who had been a domestic servant, Black woman, in his household. And it seems like they had a somewhat complicated relationship. He did not publicly acknowledge her But it seems that he did provide, various forms of financial support. At any rate, her name was finally added to the Strom Thurmond statue as another one of his now officially recognized children.
And this may sound a little naive, but I'm curious what your perspective is. I was familiar with the basics of that story, but I wonder what you think when you're chronicling and examining history from the 1700s, the 1800s, and then you come to a story like that one. I mean, 2003 is, for a person my age, is not that long ago. I remember 2003 vividly, and yet that's as close to kind of a Civil War type circumstance that you can come to, and it's right here in the 21st century.
Right. I mean, it's Civil War circumstance. Go back to, if you go to Monticello in Virginia, Thomas Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings, an enslaved woman, someone who he owned legally. He also had six children with her. And that story is right front and center at Monticello. Jefferson, far more than Strom Thurmond, is someone who went around talking about, this thing called all men are created equal, some famous words that Jefferson wrote. And so I think that you see strains of this story all through American history. It's very interesting also to think about what it is that people are willing to acknowledge and understand as history at different moments, right? It's no coincidence that actually both Thomas Jefferson's story and Strom Thurmond's story came out roughly in the same moment, which is, for 200 years, Jefferson's had been pushed to the side. And so I think people are starting to engage with, understand some of these complications, understand the violence and often the sexual violence that was at the heart of systems of racial subordination, and really wanting to think about those as history, even when, the quote unquote great men are part of that story too.
And you write, this is harsh, but blunt and true. You write at one point in the book that during the time of enslavement and perhaps sometime after that, that for white men, rape could equal profit, which is absolutely horrible to even ponder, but factual.
Right. This is something historians have been doing a lot of work on, thinking about slavery not just as a racial system, as a social system, as a labor system, but also as a system of reproduction for profit. And so you can see that. And actually, when you travel the country, you can also see that system developing. I spent some time in Virginia looking at slavery in the 18th century. Virginia is a place that actually even earlier than that in the 1660s makes this very deliberate decision, which says that slavery is going to be enslaved status, legal status is going to be heritable, and it is heritable through the mother. And so that means, by definition, that any children born to an enslaved woman are themselves enslaved and therefore become the property of the man who owned her.
You mentioned Virginia and Monticello. You also went to Mount Vernon, George Washington's home. And I thought it was compelling that you mentioned before you even get into Mount Vernon, you have to wrestle with what we call Mount Vernon and Monticello and these founding fathers' homes, because it's gone from farm to plantation to now slave labor camp, similar to how we've gone from slaves to enslaved. Why is the language so important around these events and places?
I think the language is important because it's that language that allows you to see certain aspects of what's there and to hide others. The example that I use in the book about why this might matter is, the famous moment, this incredibly important moment in American history when, after two terms, George Washington decides that he is going to step down as president, facilitate this peaceful transition of power that has become so much a part of American identity, fundamental to American democracy. And one story One version, one language says he resigned from that position and returned to his farm to be, you know, a yeoman farmer and an ordinary citizen. Another version says that he resigned from, well, he didn't really resign, he stepped down as president of this great new Republic of Liberty to return to the slave labor camp that he ran in Virginia. And those are two very different ways of describing the same story, and they make different pieces of it visible.
You, as I mentioned, detail the difficult histories of Washington, Jefferson, James Madison. And in telling those stories, you also tell the stories of Ona Judge and Paul Jennings and Sally Hemings, who you mentioned earlier, who Annette Gordon Reed so famously and vividly showed to be the mother of Thomas Jefferson's children. What do their experiences tell us about their enslavers, and how does that color your perception of those men?
Well, one thing that I found by traveling through Virginia, as opposed to just reading these stories, was what a tight-knit society it was. So particularly for Jefferson and Madison and Monroe, I mean, they were neighbors. They lived right near each other. They were constantly influencing each other, and they were, you know, embedded in a very particular kind of 18th century society that helped to produce both their ideas about liberty and then, of course, their commitment to slavery. The other thing that is really interesting in going to these sites, Mount Vernon, Monticello, Montpelier, Colonial Williamsburg, and there are others, is that they each address the question of slavery slightly differently. I mean, there's no more, you know, in the old days, you could go to a plantation site like that and hear very, very little about slavery at all. That's not true in any of these places. And yet they've each kind of taken this opportunity to emphasize different aspects of it. At Mount Vernon, a lot of it is about the sheer labor of keeping a place like Mount Vernon going, with hundreds and hundreds of enslaved people who were skilled craftspeople, who were skilled, you know, chemists and agricultural experts, and doing the work of Mount Vernon. At Monticello, it's really about Thomas Jefferson, Sally Hemings, these familial relationships. At Montpelier, it's very much about the contradiction between, you know, writing a document like the Constitution, having these high-flown ideas about liberty, and having this community of enslaved people who were your legal property.
And one of the points you make several times that is so important is that these great men couldn't have these great thoughts or have the time to formulate these great thoughts if someone else wasn't out there doing all the labor to keep these places going. We're going to talk about that and much more, including sleeping in a silo, when we come back. More with Beverly Gage and This Land Is Your Land right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. My guest is Beverly Gage. She won the 2023 Pulitzer Prize for her biography of the former FBI director J. Edgar Hoover. Her new book is This Land Is Your Land, and it tells the tale of her 13 road trips to 300 historical sites across the nation. Three of the places that you highlight are Colonial Williamsburg, Greenfield Village in Michigan, and Disneyland. And each one represents a version of our history as envisioned by, for lack of a better term, rich guys. John D. Rockefeller, Henry Ford, and Walt Disney. And you've said in recent interviews that you're fascinated by what wealthy, powerful people like those three do to remember the past. So what were your lasting impressions of those three very different places?
You wouldn't think of them as places that have much in common, but I did see them as being connected in precisely the ways that you mentioned, that they are sort of the visions of extremely rich men. Each one of them, not Walt Disney, but both Henry Ford and John D. Rockefeller, for some moment were the richest man in the country, if not in the world, who decide that they want to put their stamp on history. And one thing that I found sort of touching about these stories is that each one of them was sure that the moment that he was living in was a fallen moment, a terrible moment. And so these sites are often an attempt to recapture a more virtuous past, a time when people were really patriots, or when life was simpler, or when, you know, men knew how to be men, or whatever the theme might be. For, you know, John D. Rockefeller, he's looking back to the 18th century. For Henry Ford, he's looking to the mid-late 19th century. And for Walt Disney, who is the youngest of the three, he's looking back to the turn of the century. And in fact, Disneyland is built really around his own childhood memories of Marceline, Missouri, when he lived there. And that's Main Street, USA. That's supposed to be Marceline in 1900. So that's sort of touching and human. But of course, each one of them also wanted to tell sort of a heroic story about the United States that included some things, left out a whole lot of others. I would say, especially in Henry Ford's case, you know, his most famous statement about history is the phrase, "History is bunk." And what he meant by that, it was a kind of fake news, the historians are all lying to you. And one of his main objections was that it didn't pay enough attention to businessmen and scientists and innovators like himself, who were the real movers and shakers of history. And so he built an entire historic village devoted to that theme.
I am a little bit trepidatious to ask you the natural follow-up, which is, who is most likely in our current crop of zillionaires to build historical monuments to themselves or their time?
Well, I shudder to think in certain ways. And yet I am actually also very, very curious about what the story would be and what that experiment might be. There is, I believe, in DC, a new Museum of the American Experience of Free Enterprise, built by Michael Milken, who, if people know Michael Milken, it's usually because of his role in kind of junk bond scandals of about 20 or 30 years ago. So there are rich people out there who are attempting to retell their story of America. I mean, it'd be kind of interesting to see what Elon Musk would do with such a thing. But, you know, many of the Silicon Valley guys like Henry Ford also famously say they don't read books. And so I'm not sure historians would have much influence over this.
Muskville, it's in your future. Speaking of wealth and business, you also toured the Ford River Rouge manufacturing site in Dearborn, Michigan, which I'm ashamed to say I was not familiar with. And I was amazed by the scale of what you described, and that there are areas that are still off limits even now. Now, they do produce the Ford F-150 there. This was built, I believe, around 1928. What do you think would be a comparable achievement today? In other words, is this kind of ambition still possible?
That's a great question. When the River Rouge was built in the 1920s, it was a marvel, not only for people in Michigan or the United States, but around the world. It was the largest industrial facility that had ever been built. And it was really Henry Ford's vision of, you know, you're going to bring in the raw ore and the wood, and everything's going to happen there. And you're going to pop out all these Model Ts on the other side. So it was really this amazing model of vertical integration. And it was just huge, went on, you know, for more than a mile in each direction. And so you can still go there on a tour through the Henry Ford's historic museum, and you kind of ride in on a bus. And I honestly had never seen anything quite like it. The scale, the scope, the smokestacks, the buildings that each have a different role to play. A lot of it is not being used by Ford now, but they do allow you to tour one active factory, and that is where, at least at the time I visited, they were making the Ford F-150. And so it is itself a kind of marvel of industrial production.
Yeah, and I wonder, I guess since we're such a tech-heavy world, maybe it's some kind of supercomputer or data center or something. I don't know what the comparable would be in our time.
Well, I do think it's interesting to look at all the data center production that's going up right now. It does remind me, actually, not so much of industrial facilities, but of the railroad, of all that infrastructure that was built in these kind of wild boom and bust cycles in the 19th century. This seems a lot like that to me, honestly.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good comparison. You sticking with the business and work theme, your travels in the Midwest lead you to some of the miserable conditions people worked in industrial Chicago. You go on to Terre Haute, Indiana, where you encounter the legacy of Eugene Debs, who was a socialist and a labor leader and ran for president five times in the early 1900s. I didn't realize that. Look out, William Jennings Bryan. And you make the observation that, quote, our historical landscape tends to ignore labor and working class history, end quote. Why do you think we ignore that history?
It was something that I noticed in lots of places. You know, I went to Dearborn and I went to Chicago and Terre Haute because those were places where they're really trying to grapple with that history. I think in part it's because when these industrial facilities are taken down, they're really gotten rid of. But I think more deeply that Americans have always been quite uneasy with the question of class. And in fact, you know, the labor movement has had its ups and downs, and we actually in this country now have a labor movement that percentage-wise anyway looks a whole lot more like what it looked like in the late 19th century than what it looked like in its heyday. So I think some of it probably reflects the, you know, the priorities and the strength of the labor movement itself. But we still tend to mostly have sites that are about famous events, famous people, and the texture of everyday life, how people worked, how they lived, is always a little bit harder to capture.
I'm going to ask you this question, that question a little bit differently, which is I want to read you this excerpt from the book. You write this: statistically speaking, we live in a society that looks a lot like Gilded Age America, with a tiny class of fantastically wealthy families on top and millions of others struggling just to get by. We have a lot less of that era's radical class politics, which proclaimed that extreme inequality was corrupting, immoral, and undemocratic. Why do you think there is not more of a backlash given those circumstances?
Yeah, it's a really important contrast. Chicago, my chapter on the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era, the late 19th, early 20th century, is not only about the growth of these big cities and the growth of industry, it's about a ferocious struggle that was underway during those years between labor and capital, as people would have identified it, the Haymarket bombing, the rise of the socialist movement, the Pullman strike, all of these really important and often revolutionary conflicts that were underway. So why don't we have that? Well, of course, the Democratic Socialists seem to be having a little comeback in our moment, but that's as yet, you know, TBD, whether that's going to be a big deal or not. I think in that period, there was a sense that the future was going to belong to labor, that the future was going to belong to socialism. That was firing a lot of this energy. And I think, you know, we live in a post-Cold War world. People's quality of life in many ways is much, much higher now, even though our statistics of inequality look much the same. And I think some of the struggles and failures of the past have kind of cowed certain people in our own moment to take up those traditions once again.
Well, let's go from class war to nuclear war. As I mentioned, you slept in a former missile silo. It was in Roswell, New Mexico. It's been converted into an Airbnb. This is such an American story in and of itself. You describe it as deathly quiet. What made you forsake Hilton for ICBMs?
I went to the Southwest, New Mexico and Nevada in particular, to think about the Second World War and the Cold War. And of course, these are not wars that in some technical sense happened on American soil. That's not where the battles were fought. But they transformed the United States nonetheless through military investment, through the creation of, you know, the whole military and defense infrastructure that we still have today. So I went to Los Alamos. I went to Nevada, you know, thought back about the days when you could go to Las Vegas and watch an actual nuclear test happening out in the desert. And that was just part of your tourist activities.
That was insane, by the way. I'm sorry to interrupt you. That was insane. Like the depiction of a pretty girl on a mushroom cloud. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That just... Exactly. No, Vegas used to sort of advertise this up. You can come, you can have an Old West experience, you can do some gambling, and you can watch a nuclear weapon go off in the desert. They stopped above ground nuclear testing by the 60s, but you know, for the 50s, that was a real attraction. My time in a missile silo was, as you said, outside of Roswell, New Mexico, and there is a local man who has bought up a couple of old Atlas missile silos. So that was really the first generation of ICBMs. And it wasn't a great weapons program. And so it only lasted a couple of years. And when the government decided to shut it down, they pulled the weapons out, but they actually left the silos there. And so for decades, you know, local teenagers would go. That's a pretty good way to get away from your parents. You go party, you know, graffiti, the whole thing. In the silos, but this is now a silo that's been converted in a really wonderful way into an Airbnb, and it's full of, you know, period missile design and development magazine from 1962 is your reading available in it. But there's it's a full service little apartment down there, and you're just way underground and kind of face to face with some of the both most prosaic and most daunting pieces of this kind of nuclear infrastructure that was built.
May I ask what kind of rate the ICBM hotel might fetch?
I don't remember the exact rate, but it was pretty expensive. It was probably more than your Hilton because a lot of work went into it. And actually, the man, it's named Gary Baker, who runs it. He lives in the silo himself full time.
Wow. We have to hit the serious topics because everything was so light before, of course. and what I mean by that is we need to talk about you going to the world of Coca-Cola and Beverly having a sip of Beverly. What was that like?
This was part of the chapter on Atlanta, and Atlanta became my place to look at the history of the New South. So post-Civil War, late 19th, early 20th century, the South's trying to reintegrate into the country, and Atlanta was really the standard bearer of that whole period. That is what Coca-Cola comes out of. Coca-Cola is a product of the 1880s, and so I went to the world of Coca-Cola, which is right there in downtown Atlanta. I think most people don't go there seeking history, but you know, I spent some time with the historic exhibits and trying to figure this all out. But I ultimately went to a room called Taste It, where you can taste all of these Coca-Cola products from around the world. And I was very excited to see that there was a drink named Beverly, because there aren't that many things named Beverly in the world. And so I took a sip of it. And it turns out that this is the worst drink that Coca-Cola has ever made. It's so terrible. It has no sugar in it. It's like the most bitter thing. And so it's actually been discontinued, but it has this kind of cult following because it's so, so terrible. You can only get it at places like the world of Coca-Cola now.
So how soon are you going back? Is this something you're going to brag to your family about?
Well, you know, I feel a little loyalty to it still, but I'm not sure that I'm going to drink it ever again.
That's a ringing endorsement. Now, you say you write in your introduction that you wrote this book to escape 10 years of J. Edgar Hoover. Now you've done the road trip book. What do you think you'll do next, or do you know?
I do know, and I actually knew even when I started this book that I'm doing another long biography of a man who was a major figure of the 20th century, someone I'm going to have to spend a lot of time with, and that is Ronald Reagan. But I wanted to do a little bit in between. This book, as you might have noticed, the last chapter ends in Reagan's Southern California. I make a visit to the Reagan Library, and that's partly because it was a natural place for that all to go, but it was also because I have been thinking a lot about Ronald Reagan, and I am going to have to spend a decade with him, so I thought I'd visit and at least say hi first.
The beautiful symmetry is that Reagan, the image maker himself, helped introduce Disneyland, as you write. But that's for another show. So I want to thank you, Beverly Gage, for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Beverly Gage's latest book is called This Land Is Your Land. Thanks for listening today to Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Have a great day, everybody.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.